Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Angela Alberti.
Okay, super excited about our show today. I am speaking with the H-1B guy, Rob. I'm so excited to have you today. Let the audience know a little bit about yourself before we get started.
Well, hey, Angela, thank you for having me on today. Really excited. My name is Robert Bouchard. I am the H-1B guy. I grew up in a small town called Brunswick, Georgia, on the coast of Georgia. Went to Georgia Southern University in Statesboro and made my way to Atlanta. And in the early 2000s, kind of found myself in technology and then recruiting. And then here I am today, the H-1B guy. So really excited to jump on today with you.
Awesome. H-1B, the world of work visas and immigration policies. But before we get started and dive into the nitty gritty, I want the audience to get to know you just a little bit better. You gave us a great introduction. We know you're a Georgia boy, and where you were born and raised, but let us know, what's a hobby of yours?
So I have this really weird obsession with Walt Disney World. I don't know why, I just do. I'm love music and definitely very avid sports, golf, tennis, coaching my kids and youth sports. So really keep busy outside, try to stay as active as possible. So
okay, so you sound like the perfect dad. Walt Disney and avid sports and coach. So
yeah, no, pretty cool. I don't like to say no to adventure. Let's just leave it at that, right?
Okay. Yeah. So if you could choose anything, what would your last meal be?
Yeah, I guess I'm a barbecue guy, right? So you know, if it had to be one protein, I have this hankering for smoked chicken with white sauce. And a lot of folks don't know what white sauce is. They kind of grew up in Alabama and it's very regional. It's like a mayonnaise vinaigrette based sauce. And yeah, I'd say that with some greens and maybe some mac and cheese. I think that would fill me up, right?
Good old Southern boy. Mm-hmm. Love it. Love it. Okay, if you could have any dream job in the world, what would it be?
Yeah, I grew up with this dream of being a professional golfer. Unfortunately, I didn't want to practice or work hard enough to get there. I was pretty good. But, you know, those guys, you know, they live a very privileged life, but they do so because they are the best at what they do in the world.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah, I think for me, you look at what goes into being a professional golfer, the time, the dedication, the travel, but you know, they see every corner of the world. And for me, that was always something that I dreamed about.
Yeah. It takes a lot of dedication, but pretty cool. I think a lot of guys have out there some kind of professional sports player. I know my husband does as well. So congratulations. You survived the round of fire and ice questions. We got a chance to get to know you a little bit better and break the ice, but now let's delve into who you are. So tell us a little bit about your story and how you became the H-1B guy.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I graduated from Georgia Southern University 2003, and my first job out on the street was selling credit card machines. And then I had a company that was a technology-based company give me an opportunity to really beat up the phones inside sales. And I took this interest into systems and networking and was like, wow, this is pretty cool. Technology is amazing in what it does, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, worked for that company for a while. And then I got into doing recruiting for them. They had some needs and I helped them out. And all of a sudden I realized, wow, there's some big money to be made in these agency recruiters. I had met some people just through networking and realized the kind of money that they were making. And so I took the jump to agency and I did that for 15 years. Wow. And, you know, worked for a couple of different agencies and had the opportunity to be introduced to corp to core based business, which is, you know, subcontracting based business and staffing. Mm-hmm. And started to take this interest into these different types of visas and understanding it. and had the opportunity to manage a large immigration program that basically we built from the ground up at one of my former employers. And then, you know, like a lot of people, I think March 15th, 2020, was kind of the day that a lot of our worlds, you know, changed overnight. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to be in a position to kind of survive, you know, over the next, you know, few months. But like a lot of organizations, you know, companies are out there, we're trying to figure out, you know, how do we cut costs and keep the lights on, right? And so, you know, ultimately staffing business was impacted pretty swiftly.
Tremendously.
And a lot of that was the contingency-based staffing, which is what I have done for a large part of my career. And I was helping, you know, lead delivery strategy over a very large enterprise account, and that account was impacted significantly. And so, you know, my role was impacted right before Memorial Day. And, you know, in hindsight, at the time, wow, it was a bit of a shock. I can't say that like a lot of us didn't foresee it. But what I decided after that was like, I'm going to take Memorial Day off and just kind of unplug, right? And decompress what's going on. And so, you know, fast forward 3 weeks later, really mid early June, I had this vision of the concept of the H-1B guy come to me. And what I realized is that I have this very unique skill set in staffing and in business in general, which is I understand the inner workings of the temporary foreign worker and the various work authorizations that go along with that. And I also understand the relationships between third parties, subcontractors, and firms and how they manage human capital flow. Right. And so I started looking out there and I'm like, wow, the only people that are really talking about this are folks that are on these work visas and attorneys.
Yep.
And I said, wow, there's a gap in the market. And quite honestly, I love to talk. I love to write. And I said, you know what? I know I can help businesses solve problems. And I have a lot of relationships. And so I'm just going to put myself out there. And I took a couple of weeks, created the H1BGuy.com, did everything with my iPhone 11 and a Chromebook until I could get some revenue going and afford to buy the laptop that I now use. And it's piece by piece, like when I started shooting my YouTube videos, I was using an industrial work light. But what I realized is it doesn't matter what your setup is or how much you invest in it. It's get quality content out there.
Right.
So I started talking about this H-1B visa, but I quickly realized, wow, this is much bigger than H-1B visa. There's all these other types of work authorizations out there. And then in the news in July was this Senate Bill S-386, which was part of removing the green card backlog, removing country caps for employment-based preferences. And all of a sudden, my political sort of interest overlapped with my professional, and I had a platform. And I had this voice that, wow, just very quickly, in a matter of 30 days, I started getting all these messages of these people saying, thank you for talking about this. Thank you for bringing this story to light. And I'm like, wow, this is really something that I'm onto, you know, and to back that up, I put myself out on LinkedIn, which is where you and I found each other.
That's
and
right.
I had a client that reached out to me day one that said, I need your help and I need it now. Can I talk to you tomorrow? And I said to myself, Angela, wow, you're onto something.
Yep.
And so that's where the H-1B guy.
The H-1B guy was born.
Born. Yep.
Boom. So dedicate 15 years to staffing, all of a sudden found yourself in the middle of a pandemic, laid off, and you made yourself into somebody. And you're right. That's exactly how we met. You've gained quite a bit of traction.
Yeah.
So I'm super excited to talk to you about this because we look at H-1B and work visas. I've been in staffing most of my career. I know I've been on the phone with the people that were holding the visas, the people trying to get those people to get to work. I know that there's a lot of relevancy, particularly in the white collar world,
mm-hmm.
where you look at IT and engineering mm-hmm. And STEM work. And, you know, there's relevancy behind this population. So tell us a little bit about, you know, that candidate experience and what mm-hmm. has led them to the options that this type of worker is limited with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, for any of us who have spent any time in staffing or just as an employer or a business owner that is looking to hire, Right. Because at the end of the day, that's really what we're talking about is human capital. H-1Bs just happen to be temporary foreign workers in that human capital designation. And so what happens in the cycle is that there are tech startups, and then there are these large enterprise organizations that decide we're going to implement this very niche technology into our platform. And so when they make that decision, a lot of times in that process, they don't realize what they have to do to recruit, attract, and hire the person who can implement it if it's not some sort of managed services agreement that they have in place with a team of developers that's going to come in and do it. So when they try to augment their staff, they have positions that go unfilled for very significant amount of times, right? That kind of time to fill. And so jobs are left unopened, they're left unworked. And what I realized very quickly is that if you can build a network within this pool of candidates, they're much more likely to refer you to somebody just because they're always looking out for their friends because they know they have to maintain status, right? And so what I realized is that H-1Bs fill this very sort of niche gap in a lot of high tech space. And a lot of it's development. A lot of it are these one-off systems that have their own sort of code behind it. And the reason being is that they are trained very early on in technology. Whereas when we go through school, it's a lot of liberal arts. It's a lot of, you know, sort of social skills and things like that, that, you know, US history, right? Not that those things aren't important, but right. we're not only more recently has technology become part of the learning institution in US schools. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the gap was created, right? Is that there aren't enough high tech resources to fill the high tech needs in large enterprises and tech startups. And so what happened is you have this shift starting in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and the H-1B lottery and the excess of visas that was added in the early 2000s, it created this significant influx of inbound individuals, specifically from India and China.
Wow. Wow. Interesting. So let's go into the next question then. Let's say you go to sleep and you wake up and you're all of a sudden in your dream world. What do you think would be the most significant impact that we could apply starting tomorrow to help this H-1B and the H-1B lottery process for this very untapped part of the worker candidate pool?
So H-1Bs come with a pretty restrictive employment process. And so there's two ways that individuals can be awarded an H-1B. There's exempt and then there's non-exempt. Mm-hmm. So exempt means that they work for a nonprofit institution. Think medical doctors, nurses, things like that, where researchers, where they're not, the company they work for has a nonprofit designation. And so they are CAP exempt, meaning that the employer can petition for their H-1B at any time during the year, as long as they have the appropriate documents. Then there is the non-exempt. And so that means that you have to be awarded through the lottery. And each year there are 85,000 H-1B visas that are awarded in the annual H-1B lottery that's selected and opened on April 1st. And so you have two different pools that they pull from, 65,000 that are generally pulled from foreign nationals with bachelor's degrees outside of the US. And then you have another 20,000, which is advanced U.S. degrees. So foreign nationals who have come here and gotten a master's degree in the U.S. And so for a very long time, it was random selection. And what would happen and what a lot of the large outsourced employers have learned is that they flood that lottery with multiple petitions. The more petitions they submit, the higher probability they would have to be selected, almost gaming the system, if you will, versus a small employer who maybe has two needs and submits two cases, but only gets one. And so what is it, this created is really no rhyme or reason other than random selection. Well, one of the things that's been in the news here recently is that the wage rule changing the way the H-1B lottery will be selected this year. And so what the new rule states, and this has been contested and there's some questions about being debated, but I think this is a step in the right direction because what it will do is in turn make the H-1B lottery based on wages, There's no more random selection to it. So employers who are willing to pay H-1Bs the most salary, right, are going to be the ones who are going to be selected. And so what that ends is the cheap labor debate. It ends the displacement of American workers debate. It basically says that I'm willing to pay this foreign national more than market value, more than the prevailing wage determination, so that I can get this resource here on U.S. soil because I need to fill this position, versus large outsourcers that are submitting 2, 3, 4, 5,000 petitions and getting half of those, right? Wow. Because last year, I believe the number was 275,000 petitions for the lottery USCIS received for 85,000. So those numbers don't line up.
275,000 petitions, 85 of those actually get approved, some of which are coming from bachelors in those countries. Some of them are getting their master's here.
Correct.
But that wage limit, you think that you see that as a major improvement, at least a step in the right direction.
That's correct. And if you talked to, I'd say 90% of H-1Bs that are here, 9 out of 10 that are here currently working in the U.S., mm-hmm. that are mired in this green card backlog that we'll talk about. But what they would tell you is that they are in favor of this, because right. what it shows is their value is based on their merit and skill. It's based on what they're paid. It's not based on a random selection of, hey, you meet the specialty occupation requirements, but I only have to pay you $75,000 because that's the prevailing wage determination for that position. Wow. What that means is that the Department of Labor is stating that these are the minimum salary that you would pay that individual. And so the lottery, based on the actual employer offer letter that states the wage that's entered in electronically and selected based on that, would end a lot of this.
Wow. Okay. So you may have mentioned some of this, but now we're headed into a new administration. We've got mm-hmm. Biden on the radar to become president. We know some of the steps back, or at least things that didn't advance us as far as it could with Trump. Mm-hmm. But what do you see some of those other improvements taking place under this potentially new administration to look like with Biden?
Yeah, I think, as I just mentioned about the H-1B lottery wage level, you know, this was something, proposal for rulemaking that the Trump administration just put in going back to November. And so this is kind of their parting shot. The announcement came out last week from USCIS that it would be implemented, but this is actually a very big feather in the Trump administration's cap. I think where they missed the mark is he ran on merit-based immigration in 2016. We saw, the RAISE Act come into the Senate, the Cotton Bill, as I refer to it, in 2017. And then we didn't hear anything after that. And it was more of an assault on the temporary foreign worker. I think with the new administration coming in, you'll see, President-elect Biden, soon to be President Biden, come in and start to rescind some of these executive actions. I don't know how many, and I don't know how much he's going to go towards the H-1B. I think he may just kind of sit back and let some of these happen. What I really believe is going to happen, and if you read a lot into what the transition team is saying, is that I believe that we'll see new legislation through Congress come up. And I predicted this a few weeks ago, June or July. By July, I think we'll see some new immigration legislation that's going to have some carryover language from Senate Bill S-386 that I mentioned. And a couple of those big things that relate to the H-1B visa employee are the 50-50 rule, which says that if employers have 50% or more H-1Bs on their staff, they can no longer be awarded new H-1Bs in the lottery. So that curbs the H-1B sort of cycle, and employers who are fully reliant on H-1Bs, that's a big one. The other one is the whistleblower penalty. So right now there really aren't a lot of pushback employment-based penalties for H-1Bs employees that are willing to speak up when they know that there's known fraud. And so that's another big sort of protection for H-1Bs. Of course, back in August, when the Biden administration put out their policies on immigration, very way down in the bottom, he talks about he doesn't agree with country quotas for employment-based preferences. And for those who aren't familiar, there are 140,000 employment-based preference green cards issued every year. But there is a 7% cap on your country of birth. So that means that if you are from the United Kingdom and your employer sponsors you, there's a 7%, only 7% of those 140,000 can be awarded to individuals from the United Kingdom. So when you go back and look at, you know, as we talked about, 70% of H-1Bs are from India and this pipeline and cycle that it's created, think about the number of individuals from India that are mired in this backlog. And so I think you'll see the Biden administration target removing the country cap quotas. I also think that they will come up with some different transition for removing the green card backlog. So all of this and how it impacts our staffing world is that at some point transitioning in the next 5 or so years, we are going to see a plethora of H-1B employees that did not have W-2 freedom, meaning they couldn't really pick who they wanted to work for, where they wanted to work, and how much they wanted to be paid, because a lot of that was mandated by law. You'll see them start to hit the market. And what that's going to do is it's not necessarily going to create an influx of human capital, but what it is going to do is make more highly skilled individuals with years of US experience start to look and see, is there something else I want to be doing? And so that's what's so big about clearing this backlog, is that it will help us move forward in that war on human capital, because right now they're in a cycle and they don't have freedom.
So big advances coming our way. Let me see if I could recap it. So we've got the wage merit and getting the visas that way. We've got the cap happening, so any employers over 50% ratio will be limited.
Mm-hmm.
We've got some major changes headed with Biden and what he plans to do with visas. And, you know, as we're coming up on time, it looks like we've got about time for about two more questions. But as an employer, what do you need to do to remain attractive to this candidate pool? And what are some investments that you can make if you have the need to get some of these type of workers out on your payroll mm-hmm. and working for you?
So, you know, I think a couple of things are the war on capital that's happening is also borderless. And so I think that's the bigger thing, is that right now people are sitting anywhere they want in the US and also in the world. And so I think giving your employees that freedom to choose, you know, where they want to work and when is really big in the new society that we have. But I think if I'm a company and I'm looking to hire H-1B visas, I'm going to want to do a couple of things. First of all, I want to make sure I have a really good immigration attorney on retainer. It is number one. You have to have it, whether you are going to hire one or you're going to hire 50. You've got to have a great immigration attorney. Second, you've got to have a compliance process in place, because what you don't want is ICE walking through the door asking you for documents on certain employees and you cannot produce them. That's a big no-no. So at the end of the day, to attract this type of employee, what you have to do is make them feel wanted. And how do you do that? You do that through paying them a fair wage, above market value in many cases. So money, right? It is a huge influence. The other way that you do that is giving them that path to permanent residency. So that would be employment-based green card sponsorship. I can tell you in all of my years of working with H-1B employees that have been here in this country for 2-3 years, their two motivators are generally money and green card. The third one would be they're going to learn a new technology or skill, right? And then the fourth is who the employer is for the resume, that name recognition. And so if I'm an employer and I'm looking to build these programs, I want to make sure that I'm going to start, it's like you're baking a cake, at the very bottom level to tier yourself up. I'm going to identify who the immigration attorney is that I'm going to use. I'm going to bring somebody like me on to help guide them in that process and make sure that their compliance is in place, that they have all of the appropriate processes in place before they even get to thinking about bringing an H-1B on board. And then when you get to that point, it's going to be money, your commitment to their permanent residency, the technology they're going to get to work on, and who you are and where you're going as an employer.
Wow. Money and green card. That's where it seems to be a lot of it, where it's starting to at least attract these workers along with everything else that you mentioned, perhaps investing in another skill. So
I would say one more thing on that too, yeah. Angela. I think a lot, and I've seen this a lot, is that the stability aspect of who you are as an employer and making them a permanent employee versus a subcontractor of a subcontractor, or what we refer to as layering in our right. staffing world.
There's I think a lot that, of that.
That in and of itself, I failed to mention that, but to me, it resonates with the temporary foreign worker is that they are your permanent employee. It mm-hmm. gives them purpose. And I say them in the sense that as a whole, it really does. It has been proven in all of my conversations that I have that the H-1Bs that are permanent employees versus the H-1Bs that are working for a consulting firm or layers, the ones that are perm are generally much more happier and satisfied in where they are than the ones that are working through consulting firms.
Which... by default, if you're helping them attain a green card through that retrospect, it's because you're offering some form of permanent employment, I'd imagine, right?
Correct. And investing thousands of dollars in them, right? That's the other side of it. We're talking about thousands of dollars in investing in them.
Right, right. And I think we can dedicate an entire episode to what an investment is into H-1B statuses and the requirements right. that an employer has to uphold, because I know that is a very complex situation in itself. But tell me if you could give one reason, right, on why we face a big risk if these certain policies aren't improved, but it does seem like we're headed that way. But what's the biggest thing that's at mm-hmm. stake for the US worker population if some of these improvements aren't addressed?
Yeah, so one of the stories that I told back in August is a really good friend of mine who I would consider one of the top 500 best software architects in the world. He had been here in the US for a decade. His priority date was 2012 and he wasn't seeing an end in sight. And a few years ago, he started to look at his options and he was able to navigate the system in Canada and the system in Australia. In the end, he decided to go to Australia because of a better opportunity and the climate, and quite frankly, the location in reference to India. And so the US lost on that. Our economy lost, our innovation lost. This is now someone who is doing some really cool stuff in Australia. And guess what? He could have been here doing that. But because of the way our system works, it suppresses H-1Bs from being entrepreneurs. They can't own businesses and it traps them. They have to, every time he changed employers, which he had three I-140 approvals because over that 10-year period, he changed employees three times. And so the cycle just continues. And so if we're going to break the cycle, we have to look at what that is that attracted him to Canada and Australia. And so I always come back to this merit-based points immigration system, which is instead of there being a random selection or just who's ever going to make the most, right, that it's based on your compensation, but also other factors, your command of the English language based on an assessment, the type of degree you have, the type of skill set you have, the type of experience you have, your spouse's merit and skills are also evaluated in that if the individual is married and the points weigh towards that. So what it does is it creates this huge system around merit and skill, because some of the things we've talked about on my channel, right now, the worst way to come to America is based on merit and skill. Think about that. The worst way to come to the US is based on your merit and skill, because the navigation of becoming a permanent resident for temporary foreign workers is long and winding. Whereas countries like Canada and Australia give them a pass. In 2 years, you're going to have this status. In 4 years, you'll be eligible for this status. And it's a climb up, right? It's permanent residence. It's a work visa. Then it's permanent residency. Then it's citizenship. And ultimately, that is, to me, what ends the cycle. It ends the cheap labor debate. It ends the displacement of American workers debate. It ends this game where large outsourcers are flooding the system with resources that may necessarily not be as qualified as they're perceived to be. Instead, there's an electronic vetting system that goes into it. And at the end of the day, no employer's obligated. It's up to that individual to come here and seek their opportunity and earn for themselves. And that, when that happens, and unfortunately, I don't foresee this happening over the next 4 years, but when that happens, that's when we will win the war on human capital.
That's fantastic. And not just human capital, but the innovation that these very brilliant people bring to the market and to what is the future trajectory for the U.S. and our thriving economy.
Well, and think about it. That's what our country was built on. And that's the legacy that you and I have to leave for our kids, is that we're going to advance this because technology, we've seen how quickly it moves. And one of the things I realized about the H-1B guy, and I alluded to it, is that it's not just technology. I mean, there are medical doctors that are on the front lines battling this pandemic that could very easily get sick, not be able to work for 60 days, and lose their work authorization. Wow. Think about that. Saving American lives at the risk of deportation when they came here legally. If that picture doesn't paint a horrific graphic of what's happening right now with our immigration system, specifically employment-based, I don't know what does. And if I'm an executive and I'm sitting there looking at how do I get better, how do I hire better quality, I want to come back and know that we have a system in place that's vetting everybody, whether they're American or foreign.
Yep. It goes back to the core. And as I told you, this subject at least speaks volumes to me as a daughter of an immigrant that came to this country and established their way here, and knowing exactly what that process is for her to fulfill and maintain, you know, legal work authorizations. I completely resonate with this. And I feel like this is an area that we do need to address, but it does seem like there is some glimmer of hope happening, at least with what Biden proposes to do on regulation and, you know, reporting any kind of discrepancies, the caps on each country, the adjustment of green card and the backlog therein. So we're headed towards there. And, you know, it's been great having you on this show. I hope that we can at least dedicate another episode to perhaps more focused on the employer and what they need to do to facilitate this process. I know that lots of people are going to have questions as we come up and publicize on the podcast. Where can we get a hold of you if there's any questions that come up as we're wrapping up today's episode?
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to come back on again. As you can tell, I can talk for
lengths on
this. And I think that's, you know, if I go back to, hey, you asked me where people can find me. Well, it's at the H1B guy.com. And what I want people to know is that, you know, my dream here is to continue to be recognized in the world of employment-based immigration. And so expect to hear this voice and see this face and read my writing a lot, because that's my why. And what I do is I help businesses and individuals solve complex work authorization issues in the recruitment process, while also bringing awareness to employment-based issues and benefits in the immigration system. And so you can find me at the H1B guy.com. You can follow me on Twitter at the H1B guy. Of course, please go to my YouTube channel, the H1B guy, subscribe to it. And I also have a Telegram platform as well, H1B guy channel on Telegram. And so those are the best ways to find me, and you know, subscribe to the website for the latest and greatest that I put out every month on immigration, H-1B, and news.
Channel. There's lots of great stuff on that YouTube channel that I think I have found a lot of relevancy on as being a member of the staffing industry for quite some time now. But Rob, I appreciate it. I love your story. I hope to have you back onto the show. And thank you so much to our listeners for tuning in to our show today with the H-1B guy.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.